I think this is the first time I've seen Die Hard in its totality in many, many, many years, to the point where there were scenes that I'd forgotten about. So definitely, I would not put myself in the Die Hard expert category. One might say I'm not a Die Hard fan.
I was going to make that joke, but I'm glad you did because it sounded really dumb.
Yes, I'm glad I did too. Don't you take my dumb joke vertical or medium or genre or
I thought we're on
specialty?
horizontals.
Oh yes. Okay.
Okay.
But first, before we get into Die Hard, is there something we should discuss, like in terms of follow-up, like, I don't know, growlers of maple syrup, perhaps?
Yeah, that is pretty handy follow-up, isn't it? Oh, I don't have it in front of me. What's the gentleman's name who sent us the lovely tweet of him holding up a 128-ounce gigantic growler of maple syrup?
You mean you don't know?
I know his Twitter handle.
Oh, well, this is embarrassing that you can't respect somebody who would put in that much time and effort.
Are you suggesting that he bought the maple syrup specifically for us?
Perhaps he did. Actually, what I'm suggesting is that I have also forgotten Brandon Mathis's name and was just looking it up to make sure it was Brandon Mathis and not something else. Because I
On
always just
Twitter
remember
as
it.
at iMathis, if I
Yeah,
recall.
that's I always remember it as iMathis, and then I was like, wait, does that mean his name isn't Brandon? I thought it was Brandon. And then anyway, so this is a cool story. Please cut this out. So thank you, Brandon Mathis, for sending in the maple syrup jug, because you can always have too much maple syrup, and you did. But I
Where is
hope
he
you enjoyed it.
located that he acquired such a thing?
I think he's in Alabama.
Oh dear.
Yes. Famous for their maple trees.
Yeah.
We're moving on now.
To what?
Wasn't there more follow-up?
Well, there's one that we can save till the end. Carl Holscher's podcast post, which was delightful to read.
Oh, well, I was going to mention that at the beginning. So I'll do that now and I'll ruin the ending. So I was going to say it was very nice of him to mention us, and he had some very specific examples, because I thought it was very strange when he forwarded the email to me, like almost immediately after we recorded our episode, asking for examples of things for people to send in for our end of the year show. He had such an exact list. And it turned out it was because it was going in that post. But then we've also had some terrific listener feedback from a bunch of other people. And that, dear listeners, will be going into our end of the year show. Please keep that coming. And if you change your mind on anything, like if all of a sudden you decide, I don't actually like your podcast, I rescind all of my recommendations, then please also send that in too, to Dan and at the show thing with the thing. Dan, where can people find the thing?
People can find the thing at defocus.co, and the thing associated with this episode thing would be /28.
That's a good number. It's like 4 times 7.
It's an even number. It's not a prime number. I can't think of anything else relevant to the number 28.
There are that many days in February sometimes.
Does that mean we're going to release the end of the year episode on in February?
No, of course not.
Oh.
We're going to release that at the end of the year.
I thought we were following like a Lost style clue trail
No.
that leads nowhere.
Well, it did lead nowhere. Yes. No, we're not doing any. No, moving on.
I'm out of follow-up. What do you got?
This concludes my follow-up. So I guess we just go right into the movie now.
Well, I guess. I mean, we didn't check base to see how your Monday's been. That's usually the icebreaker since there's so much tension between us normally in this conversation.
It was not great, but it was okay. It was a Monday. How was your
Didn't.
Monday?
It was fine. I went to FedEx, shipped some boxes.
Would that be in relation to a certain festive holiday approaching?
No, it's totally not.
Oh, did you put some Merry Christmas packaging tape on it?
Nope, it was clear packaging tape on boring old brown cardboard boxes full of hard drives.
Oh, because I think that kind of tape could come in handy later on for you in a certain situation.
If I were so inclined to tape a Beretta to my back.
Spoiler alert, Dan.
Okay, first of all, if you haven't seen Die Hard, you have no business listening to a podcast about movies, no matter what the movie is. Go watch Die Hard right now, feel bad about yourself, and then pretend that you have seen Die Hard 10 years ago, like everyone else on Earth.
Well, this brings up an interesting question. I haven't seen any of the other Die Hard movies.
None of them?
I saw the beginning of the second one, right when they go and do their thing. And then...
I don't... they go and do their thing?
Yeah, yeah, at the airport. they blow up the thing. And then they have their list of demands or whatever, and then I stopped watching it.
Well, that's unfortunate. Yeah, I know a lot of people, their entrance to the Die Hard, I guess we're on five, I don't know what the word for five movie series is, was
Isn't
not the
a
first
quintet?
One. Oh, God, I hope not. Their entry into the Die Hard quintet is not often the first movie, which makes me very sad because it is far and away the best of the Die Hards. Mm-hmm. But that's something I've heard before. I think a lot of people came in on three because it was more... relevant, or they played it on TV more often, but Die Hard, the first one is the best, and everyone should watch that over and over again, and forego the rest of them if they have to. But the other ones, well, some of the other ones are good. Mm-hmm. Oh. Okay, so I guess I should say the second one is good. Mm-hmm. The third one was not written as a Die Hard movie; it was written as a kind of cop movie that they turned into a Die Hard movie. The fourth one is. Teal and orange and awkward and cyber terrorism-y.
A good day to Die Hard.
Yeah.
No, that's,
no,
live
that's
free
number
or die five. Hard.
Yeah, yeah, live free or die hard.
I skipped the hard.
And then number five, a good day to Die Hard is just, it's a disaster. It shouldn't be considered a Die Hard movie. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. Are you Phantom Menacing that went out of your timeline?
I would like to. It makes me very sad. I mean, the fourth one made me kind of sad, but it wasn't as bad. But we're not here to talk about the bad ones. We're here to talk about the good one.
Mm-hmm. And that would be the 1988 masterpiece by John McTiernan. Is that how you say his name?
John I believe McTiernan? It is.
Oh, okay. Yes. And it is about a Christmas Eve office party. And a little bit of a rom-com, a strange couple getting back together, he flies in, they have an argument, you know, it's the usual stuff.
Yeah, you know that that hilarious guy Bruce Willis from that TV show where it's all about comedy and antics and love and stuff? He's in this movie.
Yes, yes, yes. I worry that he could ever carry an action role.
you sound like a studio head.
perhaps. But that's as what it turned, you know, all came together here is that literally everyone in the world turned down this movie.
Basically, yeah. Yeah. Now, you know, it's funny that there's so much like cultural ancillary stories that go along with this movie. You know, the story about how this was kind of Bruce Willis's breakout action star role. The story of how no one had any faith in him and the way this sort of changed filmmaking for a certain style of directors, and it was very influential for a lot of people. And all of that context is absent from my mind because I wasn't really paying attention to movies in 1988. So that context is not in my mind when I watch this movie. I know a lot of people can't sort of divorce the two, but it, even still, every bit of the masterpiece that is Die Hard rings true for me. And I love this movie so much that I'm almost hesitant to talk about it on this show because. I first of all, I'm worried I'm not going to properly express how much I love this movie in every single frame of this movie, which I do, and how great it is. But mostly just because it's intimidating. It's one of those movies that I watch, and even when I try to have a critical eye, I just end up getting sucked in and watching the movie because it's fantastic. I'm guessing since you haven't seen it all the way through in many, many years or ever, you probably don't have the same feelings for it.
Well... I don't have as strong a set of feelings as you seem to have. And I don't understand the whole hesitation over talking about it because it's so pure or something. I mean, this movie was hacked together. Like they started filming before they had the third act. It's held together with chewing gum and baling wire. It all works, but you know, it's not like it's something that was, you know, carved from one single block of marble all at once. This was, you know, put together piece by piece while it was being filmed. In the editing bay, being recut and music looped over and audio redubbed and everything.
Right, but I would like to point out that that is the process known as filmmaking, and all of those faults occur in every single movie ever made, and all of those decisions need to be made in editing and afterwards. And what comes out from all of those compromises isn't always a movie as perfect as Die Hard. And every little bit of the script that was cut out or removed or sacrificed made for a better movie. And that's ultimately what you're trying to do in editing. And when you cut a piece out, it's not because you failed in writing or pre-production. It's because now that you see it, how do you make the story better? And how do you distill a scene down to exactly what's going to happen? And they did a great job of making this movie exactly what it should have been. And I consider it a perfect movie in my mind.
Okay. Well, we'll revisit that thought. And
the other thing I wanted to mention is I jokingly referred to this in the tweet as the best Christmas movie ever made. And so many people are doing like that, the reverse jokey thing on the internet these days about like, oh my God, everyone says Die Hard's the best Christmas movie. And they're so tired of hearing about how Die Hard's the best Christmas movie. I don't care if you consider it a great Christmas movie or not, but any excuse to watch Die Hard is a good excuse to watch Die Hard. So suck it.
Thanks for telling our listeners to suck it.
No, I'm not talking to the listeners. I'm talking to the angry people on the internet.
Who don't listen to our podcast?
Presumably.
Okay. Well, that's a good Venn diagram to address.
I'm asking that everyone invest in the Christmas spirit and watch Die Hard just because we asked them to, not because it's a great Christmas movie.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, it's one of those things where I often forget about the Christmas component to the film. It does seem like an incidental plot device. In that it explains why he goes to LA and why there's the office party and why the building is mostly unoccupied. But it's not central to the plot in any super meaningful way. Like, it's not like Home Alone or Elf or something where it's like super heavy on the Christmas theme. It's just, it's sort of...
Well, the Christmas in Home Alone is about as relevant as the Christmas in this. It's because his family is gone and his house is abandoned. It's kind of the same thing for the building.
No, Dan, it is about the Christmas spirit. At the end of this, I don't really get like a Christmas spirit sense as much as I get sort of a redemption sense from it.
Well, there's the Christmas spirit. He was able to rekindle his marriage and fall back in love with his wife, and they mended their issues.
But that wasn't really like, it wasn't like Christmassy.
Love is not... Oh, I forgot you hate love. I'm sorry. Love is not Christmassy, I guess.
No, I'm not saying love can't be Christmassy. I'm just saying it's like, you know, a square and a rectangle. Like, sometimes, you know, a rectangle can be a square, and sometimes a square... And always a square is a rectangle. But, you know, it's... With love, it's not always Christmas. And with Christmas, it's not always love. So... wait, no, I had that back. No, never mind. Let's... no one think about anything that I just said. And so, but with Die Hard, like I don't, and I'm not saying this like I hate it or anything. I'm just trying to put it on the appropriate sized pedestal that I feel like this movie should be on. And so when I say like I don't feel like it's a super Christmassy movie, that doesn't mean I don't like the movie and I don't see that there's Christmas stuff in it. It's just that I don't feel like it is super Christmassy. So I'm putting it on the appropriate pedestal for that.
The appropriate Christmas sized pedestal. You better make sure you put a little bit of water in the bottom of that so it doesn't die. But I don't care if it's a Christmas movie or people consider it a Christmas movie or not. It's still just a great movie and one of my favorite movies for a great many reasons.
Yeah. Oh, and it obviously defined a genre, you know, going forwards into the, you know, the whole 90s and early 2000s, basically, you know, for another 15 to 18 years, there were movies being made that were, you know, Die Hard on a bus, Die Hard on a boat, Die Hard, you know, etc. It really, really changed the way that a lot of action stuff was done. And especially this whole thing of one lone guy against all odds taking down somebody else, you know? That's what this is, and it set that up to be a Christmas present for all the other following movies that came after it.
Well, the problem a lot of those other movies suffer from, including some of the Die Hard sequels, is they miss the part about how Bruce Willis in Die Hard isn't really trying to be the hero of the day. He's kind of reluctantly trapped in the building and does what he has to do to survive and, you know, help out and try and rescue his wife and all that. But like, he's not blazing a trail to kick the doors down and be the savior of everyone in the building. He's just stuck there. And that's what, that's some of my biggest problems, especially with the fifth Die Hard movie. It's just, there's no reluctance and there's no, hesitation in his acceptance of the hero role, and that's what a lot of these other movies are missing. It's the main character is so ready to kick a door down with a machine gun and go kill the bad guys rather than just trying to survive trapped in an awkward situation.
Yeah, and also he's still there's a certain movie we've already discussed on here that has parallels to this. One might say that perhaps a certain actor who might have been involved in this and a certain director who maybe had seen this might have felt that maybe a cab driver who was a reluctant ex-military guy going on a mission to save somebody and it's the woman he loves, if maybe that might have had some overtones that relate to this. I'm going to guess yes. It was Die Hard in space, but with goofy stuff. So there was that.
Oh, until you said the space part, I was totally lost. But I get you now.
How did you not get that I was talking about the Fifth Element?
the spacey bits, and you know, the other thing about Die Hard that I love so much is the story and the characters all feel incredibly grounded and realistic, and
not
so much on the Fifth Element.
No.
You don't find this to be realistic at all?
No. I didn't say at all, but not all of these characters are grounded and realistic.
Okay. First of all, I did mention that this was sort of a breakout role for Bruce Willis. And before we get any further along, we should mention that Alan Rickman came out of nowhere and knocked this out of the park with a fantastic performance.
Yes, he did. He did an amazing job as Hans Gruber. One minor fault I have is sometimes when he's doing his German accent, he sort of wobbles back and forth.
the one quibble I have is his accent in general. The scene with his American accent, which is jumping way ahead, there's no way it would be remotely believable. I don't know why he thought he could pass it off, which, I mean, you can debate how early on John McClane knew who he was, but there's no way he should have assumed that he would be able to pull off an American accent believably.
I know, but it was actually kind of funny.
Oh, yeah.
I liked it. Like that was fine. But some of the other stuff earlier on, especially when he's trying to be serious with the wobbly German accent, can kind of take you out of the moment in terms of the seriousness of it. But in terms of his presence on screen, I feel like he is 100% in there inhabiting that role. The way he looks, the way he's directed to look between different things, like he's figuring stuff out. You can see it. His character's thinking things through. He's not always saying things. So it's really good stuff for Alan Rickman. You know, he doesn't play Richard III here. There weren't five curtain calls. But he does an amazing job.
Yeah, and maybe the reason his German accent doesn't really bother me is because Alan Rickman has an Alan Rickman accent, and it's just so distinctively him, it doesn't really matter what language he's speaking to me. But the thing about you brought up the directing or his acting, and you can see him thinking. One of the things that's so great about this movie is the actual subtlety of the performances in a lot of the characters. They're all very smart characters. You can see they get it very quickly, and they don't have big, oh, I understand in a way that also, mirrors to the audience to say like, hey, see this big look on my face, audience? You should pay attention to that because I'm getting something and so should you. Like when Bonnie Bedelia, she notices the dead guy in the elevator with the ho, ho, ho on. You can see she goes almost white and she kind of like stops moving entirely because she pretty quickly recognizes what happened and the fact that it's her husband who caused this. And she's trying as hard as she can to not move and make any sort of indication to the bad guys that she's aware of who caused this. And it's a very still moment for her, but the recognition is very quick and very smart on her part. And the reason the moment works is because John McTiernan uses the camera and the movement of the camera to sort of make that moment more cinematic and make that land for the audience. He actually directs the scene and the camera to add the emphasis that she is taking away. And there's a lot of that in this movie, and I really like it.
Yeah. I mean, when you were saying all that, the only thing I could think of was Cokehead Ellis and how much I hate him and why in the world.
you're supposed to hate Ellis.
No, I know, but why in the world did she talk to him? She was just like, oh, this is obviously John. He's still alive, running around the building, screwing everything up. And then, meanwhile, he's literally snorting coke.
Yeah.
And it's just like, why would you tell him? Obviously, this is not going to work out well.
You know, he's the office little pest that everyone talks to, and he thinks he's the greatest thing. But I love when the terrorists first take over the floor, he's like pacing back and forth, super nervous, going, all right, stay calm, stay calm, stay calm. And Takagi and Holly are just sitting there actually calm, staring at him like, would you please shut up?
Yeah, I literally have no idea why he works for this company.
Because he closed his $1 million deals for breakfast.
Oh, God. he was... You know, he's the cartoon character of an 80s businessman, and he fulfills his role. He doesn't know what's going on. He gets everyone in danger. He's a big blustery blowhard. So he fulfills that. But this is also what I'm talking about, where not everyone seems totally grounded. Ellis does not seem particularly grounded to me. He's slightly heightened. Not as much as the two other characters that I think are a little on the excessively cartoonish side, which are the Johnson and Johnson FBI agents. They are a little excessive, especially when they are in the attack copter, and one of them is talking about Saigon, and then the other one is talking about acceptable losses for losing 25% of the hostages. So little cartoony.
I completely disagree. I picture those guys as guys who don't really get to do this kind of thing very often, and they have that sick sort of bent inside them that when they get a chance to go full military, they're going to do it because that's why they got into this. But when he's hooting out the door and going, just like Saigon, right? And the other guy just kind of smiles to himself and shakes his head and goes, I was in grade school, you d**k, or whatever he says. It's like, these all feel like real people. Even Ellis, he feels like a real human being. Yeah, he's a cartoon, but I know more than a few people who are cartoon idiots like him.
Okay, fine. So, should we, now that we've sort of discussed a lot of the major characters, let's just finish out the rest of the cast here. We, of course, have the lovely Reginald Vell Johnson as Sergeant Al Powell. And he is, of course, best known for Family Matters, where he played the dad for years and 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 years. So every time I see him, I'm always like, oh, it's Carl Winslow. Yeah. But that's not who it is. It is, of course, Sergeant Al Powell.
I swear the first dozen times I saw this movie, I thought when they were going back and forth on the radio, he was just calling him Pal, P-A-L. Mm-hmm. You know, like, hey, you're my pal on the radio. But I don't know, maybe they kept it intentionally similar sounding because he's Al Pal and he's my pal, but
It's like rural juror. I don't know why you put the two words together like that for his name, but it is. It's fine, though. I didn't find it that distracting. He is a great character. He's not really introduced until much later in the film. Of course, there's Argyle, the limousine driver, who we meet relatively early on. And there is, of course, our buddy, William Atherton.
Oh, yeah. Richard Thornburg, who doesn't come in until way later in the movie, but it has a delightful introduction where he's on the phone with some woman he's trying to convince that he knows Wolfgang, and they're going to go get a Christmas Eve table at one of his fancy restaurants.
Oh, God. The smarmy L.A.-ness in here is so good.
It's so perfectly William Atherton.
Mm-hmm. I thought it was a magnificent role for him. He of course plays a pivotal role in screwing the pooch. So he's fantastic. There's Paul Gleason as the deputy chief of police, who is a total moron and ruins a lot of stuff. So he's great. I don't find him to be that cartoony. I do believe that there are people that are that inept out in the world, and that they might very well be running certain institutions. So
he certainly feels like the biggest cartoon character in this to me, just in his almost slapsticky way of, like, when he gets that kind of aw shucks, I'm in the presence of power with the FBI, and, you know, when they're getting ready to shut down the power grid, he's just such a goof that I love it so much. But he's on the verge of being a little too goofy for me. But
the goofiest thing he does that I think I wouldn't have kept in the movie was when the helicopter blows up, and then he says, I guess we're gonna need another couple of FBI guys, which
that line's too good to cut, but yeah, that is a little silly.
I don't picture that being some way that someone would register that scenario unfolding, but sure.
You know, if he would have played the character a little bit more resenting of the FBI agents, you know, where they were sort of taking over his troops and sort of pushing him out of the seat of power and just sort of saying, go get me a cup of coffee, little man, or whatever. Like, I could understand him saying that line at the end of the movie with a little bit more resentment, you know. He plays it in kind of an innocent, silly, like, I couldn't think of anything else to say, which in that instance, maybe don't say anything because there's a giant fireball of a helicopter flying at you. But yeah, that's fine.
Yeah, and then there's James Shigeta, who plays Joseph Yoshinobu Takagi. And he has an important role, although he might not be around through the entire movie. That pretty much rounds out the rest of the cast, except for the thugs, like Carl, etc. But in my opinion, I don't view any of the thugs as being particularly well developed characters, including Carl, who has the most screen time, or the other loudmouth, like, hacker, safe cracker.
Theo? I love Theo.
Theo grates on my nerves.
First of all, I want to know how Theo and the other American who looks like Huey Lewis, who plays the front desk guard, like, how did they hook up with the German terrorist group? But, I mean, I don't really need that explanation, but I found them unusual matches for this group.
Well, they're not really a terrorist group. They're basically thieves. They're mercenaries. Not mercenaries, because nobody hired them. I mean, they themselves are mercenaries, probably because Hans Gruber hired them, but because I pretty much picture that's how things have unfolded here, is that, you know, he's taking the George Clooney role in Ocean's 11.
No, and he's not organizing make that comparison.
Team. He's organizing his team. They're going to go rob the casino, you know, he's got to put together everybody to go do it. But
they do certainly have a bit more of a rapport than mercenaries. Like, one of my favorite things that I don't catch very often, but I caught this time for sure, is when they're interrogating Takagi, trying to get his password for the CEO workstation. I love that Theo and Carl have a bet going about whether or not he was going to tell him the password. And Theo goes, I told you he wouldn't say anything. And just Gruber has to he's trying to maintain his intensity on Takagi and not be jokey about it. But he just shoots Theo a little bit of a glare and then goes right back to grilling Takagi. And just that weird mix of like slightly deranged humor between the terrorists and their general feeling of seriousness just plays off each other so well.
Yeah, and it does work out there, but what I'm saying is they're not like fully developed characters. Like, we don't really have any arcs for them. They don't do anything. I mean, the only thing is, like, Carl gets upset his brother's dead, but he there's no meaningful emotion there other than it's just a something to propel him in his single-mindedness towards killing John McClane. But it's not like, you know, there's a backstory or anything. Like, none of that exists. It's just like it's shorthand for this is why he wants to super kill him. That's all it is. Now that we've covered all the characters, I guess we can jump right into the plot. And we, of course, start with the scene on the airplane landing at LAX. And there is the business guy next to Bruce Willis. We start just seeing Bruce Willis's clenched hands, not knowing who it is. And we quickly come to find out that he doesn't really like flying, and the other guy gives him a tip on how he needs to take off his shoes and his socks and make little fists with his toes in the carpet first thing when he gets to a place, and then he'll feel like he's home. Bruce Willis says, yeah, sure, whatever, thanks, pal. And the other guy sees his gun, and this allows him to explain, oh, don't worry, I'm a detective. That also explains to the audience who he is, which is important later because, you know, stuff. And then he leaves and goes to baggage claim in the airport. And I think this is the Tom Bradley International Terminal, which is a little strange if it is, because that's a weird place for you to pick up your bags on your New York flight. But whatever.
Well, this was 1988. I'm sure they had I'm sure they've rearranged the airport a dozen times since then.
Yes, and they just made it worse. But he picks up his stuff and he sees the girl in the, like, I don't know how to describe those pants.
White yoga pants?
Yeah, well, like, painted on white yoga pants, like, jump in the air and attack the guy with the hug, and he's like, oh, California.
There's two of those great moments. There's that one, and then once he's at the party and the guy kisses him on the cheek and he like shoves him, that you can see that Bruce Willis is like, A, from New York, B, not really into this whole California thing, even if I wanted to come out here with my wife and give it a go, these people are alien to me.
Yeah. I wasn't such a fan of the second one. He meets the limo driver Argyle. Accepts the limo, but doesn't ask Argyle why the limo was sent or who sent it, because that doesn't happen for some reason. And then he goes to...
You did skip one part that I want to point out, okay. In that he was standing by the baggage carousel smoking in the airport. And there are so many things about this movie that are of a time that... Like, we need a new version of smoking in an airport in movies. Like, there just isn't one of those things that, like... You just look around and you go, ah, I know exactly where and when and this is. And it's just one of those things that it's a keystone that, again, when I see it, it just gives me that nostalgic feeling. Not that I ever smoked in an airport, but movies like this.
It repels me.
You watched that 8 minute collage of 80s movies that was going around on the internet a little while ago?
Maybe.
You know the one I'm talking about?
No. You have to be more specific.
It was like 30 movies cut to a techno song that somebody posted on Vimeo their favorite.
Yeah.
An entire chunk of that is just clips of people smoking in places that you're not allowed to smoke anymore.
Yeah. I don't miss that at all. And I don't miss that being inside of film. I don't think it's necessary for film language. I think it is one of those things where it is romanticized I just don't get it.
Well, it's not even the romanticizing it. It speaks to how just kind of dirty everything was back then. The simpler time when people weren't concerned as much about the cleanliness of everything and the allergies and the worrying about your health. And it's just it feels like such an 80s thing. A simpler time, a pre-internet time, I guess.
Okay. I don't know where to go with that. But going onto the limo ride with Argyle, we get the sense that Argyle hasn't done this very much and that he used to be a cab driver. And he takes Bruce Willis over to the Nakatomi Plaza building, which is really the Fox Plaza in Century City, which is right next to the Fox Studios lot, which used to be part of the Fox Studios back lot until Fox Studios sold it, because every studio was selling their back lots back then to turn into property. So that they could make money off of that. Because money, yay! Backlots, boo! So they have this skyscraper, which was actually being built at the time, which is why in all of the floors that have construction, that was actually the floors with construction. That was not a set with like a translight behind it or anything. And I think is also part of the reason why those floors look a little better, in my opinion, than the office floor, which I don't find to be particularly convincing. Now we meet, of course, the security desk guy, and we get the weird touchscreen moment with the touchscreen CRT, where he gets to enter in his wife's name, and he finds out that she changed her name, which is shorthand to the audience that things are not going well with their relationship. And then
there's so much shorthand in that scene and in the Argyle scene. I mean, there's a lot of exposition that comes out in the scene with Argyle and the drive over, but none of it really feels just blatant for the audience's sake, and none of it just feels contrived, really. The writing in the first 20 minutes of this movie is superb, in my opinion, but that's just because, like, I can see every little bit and how it fits into the story, but it doesn't feel wasted.
Yeah, well, see, that's the thing, too, is it doesn't feel like we're being talked at about the character's past. It feels like these are all very natural conversations, like some, you know, nosy driver might ask you like very personal questions, which happens from time to time, and so that allows like part of his story to unfold. The moment with, you know, the other guy seeing the gun allows part of that story to unfold. The advice that guy gives him allows for a lot of pain, and so there's really nothing wasted in here, even though there's a lot of stuff that's happening that's not actually like an action movie part of anything. But everything comes back into play here.
I guess the one thing I would point out, since we're already at this part in the movie, that felt a little bit odd, and I know it's me being overly critical, is like, why did the guard make him punch in his wife's name into the computer to find out what floor she was on if they were literally the only people left in the building? But I'm willing to let that slide because maybe he's just a guy looking for somebody who's not actually in the building. He could have been like, oh, are you here looking for the people in the party? If not, go away.
Yeah, well, maybe he just wanted to verify that he had actually had a real name to look up. I don't know. Although,
he's just here to use the restroom.
Yes. You know, this also does establish the sort of the layout of the lobby, where the security desk is, where the other security guy is, the express elevators, the computer system. This stuff will come into play later on. He goes up to the office party, and we start on this really interesting shot where we have an overview of the office from sort of like an interior second balcony that looks down on the I guess the balcony is on the 31st floor, looking down onto the 30th floor inside of this little office area. And, you know, there's like waterfall and stuff like that. And the production design here apparently was meant to mimic Frank Lloyd Wright's Falling Water, according to Wikipedia. Apparently the production designer felt that that in the 80s a lot of American culture was being bought up and sort of appropriated, and so that he felt like someone like Japanese businessmen would come in and appropriate Falling Water and build it inside of their office building, which is sort of a crazy thought to have, I think. So it's a little strange, production designer guy. But okay, whatever. If that's really really what you thought.
The office is unique, but it's also fascinating. Another reason I enjoy it is because, again, it's another thing that's of a time. Like, Takagi's office is gigantic. It's like the size of my house, and that's just not the kind of thing you see anymore. Now CEOs or whatever have cubicles because, you know, meritocracy, and everyone gets the same piece of the pie. But Takagi's like, no, I run this company. My office is going to be like 3,000 square feet.
I mean, obviously, I don't think you were paying attention to the Merrill Lynch guy getting busted for having a gold trash can in 2007. So I would say that CEOs are no longer opulent. Although I will say that Takagi seems like he treats his employees a little better than most CEOs.
He buys them, what was that, like pink or red champagne in plastic cups served by butlers.
There's no such thing as a red champagne.
Well, it was red colored as well, is what I'm pointing out. Mm-hmm. Okay. The beverage in the cup that they call champagne is red.
Okay, well, that would probably be rosé.
Who cares what it is?
There's a little accent over the
E. I'm with Bruce Willis. I take half a sip and put it back on the tray.
Oh, God, what a waste. But the part I want to get back to here is the interesting shot with Takagi. And we see the camera follows Miss Gennaro as she walks through the set. We don't really see her face yet. We just track along with her, as she rounds a corner into another hallway, and then we're following her from behind. Again, we're not seeing her face, but we know that she's important because obviously this is what the camera's paying attention to. And then she has a couple little conversations, and we finally get introduced to Bonnie Bedelia's character of Holly Gennaro. And this sort of starts to set up sort of an uncomfortable relationship that she has from her side with her husband, which I think is also interesting, because otherwise, if we just saw John's side of the story, I don't really think it would have the emotional resonance, because she, of course, calls the house, talks to the housekeeper about the kids, asks if John called. So obviously she does care if he called. It's kind of strange that John didn't call, went to LA, landed at an airport, took a limo, and hasn't said a word to her, but whatever. And then is this where we go back to Bruce Willis first coming into the party, and he's wandering around, and someone in Takagi snatches him up and then drags him back there to Holly's office, where he gets introduced to Ellis?
I do believe so.
Yeah. And Ellis is charming in that he's doing coke off of Holly's desk, which is so 80s. but he does his little thing there, and we get the sense that maybe perhaps, at least I get this sense, I don't know if you also feel the same way, that Ellis might have some sort of attraction to Holly, or likes Holly in a certain gross way, because Takagi seems sort of protective of it, of Holly, introducing, of course, John McClane as the husband, etc.
And the policeman.
Yes, yes. Like, he doesn't seem to like Ellis hanging out in Holly's office and Ellis being so casual.
No, it's like Ellis must be good at his job, because Mr. Takagi kind of suffers him doing coke off the table, and the fact that he's doing it in front of a cop, and he's like, dude, what are you doing? Get it together, at least for now. But yeah, Ellis totally has a thing for Holly, especially in that opening scene, like where you're talking about, where we're following Holly and we're not really seeing her face. The conversation she's having is with Ellis, who's trying to get her to go to dinner. Drink some nice wine in front of a fireplace with some brie, I believe was his sales pitch. And she just kind of like rolls her eyes and says, get out of here. And that's the same instance where she tells her pregnant secretary to go have some champagne, which is, I don't know if I should attribute that to the 80s or just bad advice, but that also happens there.
Yeah, she's like, oh, your kid can be tended in bar. It's fine. And it's like, what? Okay, I'm not going to pretend like I'm some kind of, you know, prenatal expert, but I don't know if I would have given the same advice to anybody. But then, you know, Bonnie comes back, Holly comes back from the records room or whatever she was off to, and she runs into all of them. And Ellis takes this opportunity to run his mouth and not let anybody else talk, which is great because it sets up how well she's doing at her job, that she has her lovely Rolex, and how he is totally disgusting and I hate him.
And I love that when Ellis is like giving his spiel, and when John first comes in, and you know, he gives him the little funny line of you missed some, because he's still got coke on his nose or whatever. You can see that John is just having none of Ellis's personality. He immediately clocks him as, okay, you're a 80s douchebag guy, and I'm just going to ignore you because, you know, I'm a New York cop and I'm a serious dude. But he just is like, I'm not falling for any of your crap. And you can tell that Holly sort of has to play both sides of that line, because she works there and she's like, yeah, they gave me a Rolex, whatever. But like, my husband's here now, and that we're on to serious business. And there's that awkward tension from like all different sides. There's the awkward tension of the fact that she's got the job and she hasn't seen him in forever, and the two versions of her lives are kind of colliding at the same time. The serious marriage, and then this kind of new career where she's in this Ellis's world of nonsense.
Yeah, and so this is kind of annoying. But then they manage to have the opportunity to get away for a second, and they go over to the other office, and John's able to wash up in the executive washroom there, and they have a conversation, a very brief conversation, in which Bruce Willis totally screws up everything, and he knows it later as soon as she leaves, that he shouldn't have opened his mouth and said everything that he said, but the start of the conversation is over where he plans on staying while he's in town. And he says he's going to go shack up with an old police officer, lieutenant chief or something that retired. And she's like, oh, where is he? And he says, Pomona. And she laughs, and he's like, well, what's wrong with Pomona? And I laugh, too, because I know where Pomona is, and I would not drive from Century City to Pomona. And if your kids are, you know, where they are located near Century City, then you would also not be driving back and forth from there to Pomona every day to visit them. So, of course, she offers a very reasonable, you know, oh, well, you can stay in the guest room, which, of course, she had kind of been planning on since she had the housekeeper make up the room just in case. So they have this little thing, and then he decides to go after her for the name change thing. And it is not a good time. Not a good way to start this whole thing rolling there, Brucey.
Well, it's, you know, she's on top of her game, and she's offering to let him come stay at her house, and he doesn't feel like the man of the relationship anymore, and like an idiot, he just blurts out the whole, you know, trying to get his man status back of, well, you don't miss my name anymore. And then they go into, if you actually listen to the words they say in that argument about what the relationship, the words don't actually make any sense, but it sounds exactly like the kind of argument a married couple would have that is completely irrational and stupid and has so much history behind it that they don't even know what they're arguing about anymore. And it's just like, oh, God. And he absolutely sticks his foot in his mouth and then bangs his head on the door jamb as soon as she leaves because he knows he's an idiot.
Yeah. And this is, of course, where the pregnant woman comes in to interrupt everything and say that Mr. Takagi wants her to come out and say something for the troops, as she refers to them. This is also where we cut away from this moment of John McClane's regret to a van and another car, Mercedes, driving on, I think, Avenue of the Stars or maybe Olympic, towards the Nakatomi Plaza. And they very suspiciously pull in, and by pull in, I mean, they're like driving way too fast for them to be, you know, normal people. And there's nobody else around, but they have the little moment with Theo and the other guy when they walk in, and he does the clever little trick of having a really loud conversation, which distracts the security officer because he's waiting for them to finish talking. And this lets them get up really close, so that they can just shoot him right in the chest. And that works out splendidly. Theo gets to work on working on the computer. The other guy goes with the flash bomb to take out the guy by the elevator. Theo is able to use AutoCAD to disable the elevator shafts.
Was that AutoCAD?
It looked like it was just drawn in like AutoCAD with like a light pen or something, and then they just like had a couple drawings they animated between. It's one of those things with like the 1980s and computer stuff where it's just like, well, yeah, so I guess you needed to spell out every little thing he was doing there with some sort of a drawing graphic thing, but
It's made specially for the movie. The one that I always remember was from Die Hard 2. I don't know if you got that far, but there's a part where they adjust some air traffic control computer, and he like types something, and there's like this diagram that shows like the ground and the airplane, and like he's typing, and then he picks up like one of those like tethered styluses and touches the CRT monitor like twice, like that's actually doing something.
Actually, that's a light pen.
No, in this instance, it's completely ridiculous looking, but it just looks like one of those pens that's tied to the counter at a bank or something, but it's kind of hilarious.
No, but they used to have those. They were light pens. They were attached. They would have light, and you could draw on the screen with them. I'm serious. Look it up.
Okay, I'll look it up, but yeah. He doesn't do any drawing. He clicks it like a mouse, but it's like a stylus on a CRT.
Okay, just look up light pens. I mean, I'm not saying that an airport ever had those. I'm just saying that was a thing that people could do. It was mostly used for, you know, computer-aided drafting, otherwise known as CAD. So they go ahead and do this whole thing of breaking into the building. The van is downstairs in the garage. They lock the garage with Argyle in it, with the teddy bear, getting drunk. And the... And Theo basically wrecks all the computer stuff so that nobody else can mess with the elevator override after he's locked out the elevators. And we finally get our first shot of Hans walking very confidently into the situation. And we are immediately understanding of the fact that this guy is in charge and he means business. And they go upstairs. And then the next thing we hear is from John McClane's perspective of the gunfire going off in the office plaza building area. He freaks out. He doesn't have his shoes on anymore because he did the stupid thing that the guy said to do.
Making fists with his toes.
Yeah. And he goes to the door, looks out the door, full of adrenaline, panicking, sees what's going on out there, sees that there are guys walking down the hallway, pulling people out of offices, including one partially topless person. And then they are going to come down to where he's at, but one of them turns around real quick, and then the guy goes to the door, and he opens it, and it's like, oh no, when he had turned around, that was when he made his little escape. And this happens like 5 times in this movie, where somebody is coming towards his position, and then they turn away for a second, and then they turn back, and then we go back to the place where he was, and then it's like, oh, he left when he wasn't looking. It's just like, okay, I understand the visual language of that after so many times that you did that, John McTiernan. But he makes his escape to the stairwell, goes upstairs, sees that there's guys with rocket launchers and crap on the next floor, goes upstairs again, hits the computer room, with all of the blinking lights in the world, and then goes up again to the completely under construction floor. This is where we have the actual action movie come into play here, and sort of set up the fact that he is in the situation where he is trapped and needs to get out of the building and hopefully get his wife out of the building. Now, Dan, would you like to describe to the audience, to our listeners, hello listeners, would you like to describe to them the events that follow next?
Absolutely. The next instance is where we have Hans doing his very dramatic speech, describing how he knows every little bit about Mr. Takagi, his history back from when he was born in 1937, all the way up until his degrees and the fact that he is a father of children. Walking through the crowd very intensely, and then eventually settles on, hello, nice to meet you, Mr. Takagi, and he smiles in his very awkward kind of Alan Rickman way, and they take Mr. Takagi upstairs to the CEO workstation, where again, they're trying to get him to unlock at least the first of many stages to get into the vault, and this is where we're revealed that the whole reason they're there is not because they're terrorists, because they're actually, they know how Nakatomi Plaza is run, and they know that he has $600 million in negotiable bearer bonds in his vault, and they want at it. And they've got this ruse of being terrorists as sort of their cover, that which they're going to play up numerous times down the line, especially once the FBI gets on the line. And they're just there to steal a whole bunch of money that this company has locked in their vault on Christmas, because that's what Christmas is all about.
Yeah, well, you skipped over one little part here where when he's initially going around asking for Takagi to come forward, Holly has this little moment where she is grabbing at his sleeve, you know, telling him not to step forward because she knows this might be bad for him. And indeed it is.
But like 2 seconds later, like when they're going through the crowd, you see Carl go through the crowd too. And he walks straight to Takagi and stands there and stares at him while Alan Rickman is walking around looking at all of the other Japanese men in the crowd. Carl is just standing there next to Takagi, staring at the side of his head. So it's like, this is a foregone conclusion, my friend. You're going to get grabbed by these guys.
Well, yeah, I have to imagine that after all of the research that they've done in breaking into this building, that they've kind of maybe seen a picture of the CEO of this company, because that would only make sense. I have to imagine that part of this is psychological. Now, when they're upstairs in that room with the executive workstation, and he refuses to give him the code that allow him access to the files, and he says, oh, well, the data would be useless to you. They'll change everything back in Tokyo.
You're not going to be able to blackmail the people.
Yeah, which I had this uncomfortable moment of realizing a certain parallel.
Yeah.
I was just like, oh, boy, Japanese company getting broken into and terrorized by people. taking things.
But they kind of play off of that in this both in this scene and when he's talking to the FBI guys later. Like, the fact that they appear to be terrorists, it leads the FBI and the police to believe that they're sort of these idealistic people who have these sort of pie in the sky demands, you know, releasing my brothers in arms around the world. Like, you know, the police buy into that so quickly because they expect them to be these goofy idealistic terrorists who just want, you know, all of our friends to be freed around the world. Meanwhile, like, they're just like, you know, they're the realists going, these guys are idiots. Who cares what they do? We're just here to steal some money and get the hell out.
Yeah. Well, that's because Hans is using his cover to his advantage here, because he knows what they're going to do. They are predictable, and they don't know what he's going to do because they don't know anything about him. So the cleverness of Hans comes up several times in this movie. And if John McClane was not in this building, his plan would have totally gone off without a hitch.
Absolutely. Yeah. He's a very smart character, and he, like you said, he's playing up the expectations of him as a terrorist, in quotes, and he totally would have had everyone looking one way, and they would have just gone the other and just called it a day, sitting on a beach earning 20% with his $630 million or whatever it was.
Yeah, and one of the things that I think really works out well here, too, is that when Takagi dies, it's sort of shocking because you don't really expect him to die so early in the film. You expect, like, they're threatening him to then turn around and say, okay, well, you know, go sit over there until you change your mind. But nope. they shoot him right in the head. Big ball of bloody goo everywhere, all over that glass door. Freaks out John McClane, who also was not expecting that. The fact that Hans does this sets him up as someone who is not to be trifled with. Like, he doesn't have his henchmen do this, which I think is a key moment in terms of setting up the character and setting up the stakes of the movie. Because if you never saw him kill anybody in this film, then it wouldn't really mean anything when we got to the final act. So it works out really, really well to do this here, even though it is a shame to lose what I think could have been an interesting character in Takagi so early on in the film. And we go to them, like, kind of hearing something, and then they go chase out after him, and he hides in the little bathroom area, and then they do the fake out, like, oh, didn't really see something, turn around thing. Anyway. Mm.
But no. Like, one other thing I want to say is, like, yeah, it is a very good point that we needed to see what he was capable of doing. But you do sort of get that sense that he came in with the plan, knowing all the contingencies, and he was perfectly fine with the need to kill Takagi. And it doesn't bother him at all. And going back to the bet where he was trying to be serious, and Theo and Carl were kind of joking about it, you see Carl give Theo $20 after he shoots Takagi in the head. So that kind of puts you also in the mental space of the whole group of what they're there to do and what they're capable of.
Yeah, and that to them, they're sociopaths. The killing him was not a big deal to anybody. And that the only reason why he was alive for as long as he was to give this code, and that was it. When he wasn't going to do it, then they just had their plan B that they were going to. It was not critical that he be alive. He runs away, and then we have the whole scene up on the construction floor.
He found a staircase through wherever he was locked, and, you know, once he hit out, he was hoping that Argyle would have heard the gunfire and called the cops, but no, of course, he's partying up in the limo, making plans for later. But he sneaks out and gets back up to the construction floor, and, you know, we get a moment where he's conflicted about the fact that he just let a man die, but also recognizes that he would have died if he would have tried to intervene and all of that. And he comes up with the clever plan of setting off the fire alarm in the hopes of getting somebody out there to foil the cover of the Huey Lewis fella sitting downstairs.
Yeah, and so he sets off the alarm, and then we see on Olympic Boulevard the fire engines all coming. in the ambulance, and then they all turn off their lights and turn around because the guy gave the guard name and said it was a false alarm. And through this fire alarm, Theo is able to say what floor it was triggered on, and they're able to go to the construction floor. They send one guy over there to see if somebody had made it away from the party. They don't anticipate, of course, that it was a former cop, and he is armed. Sure enough, we get, I can't even remember the thug's name, but it was telephone line carefully cutting guy, not
Carl's brother.
Yeah, not chainsaw cutting guy. And they have a very brutal exchange here, which culminates in a certain ride down a certain stairwell, and then a broken neck. Which is good that, you know, it was a 50-50 shot that one of them was going to land that side down. And fortunately for us, it would have been a very different movie if it had been the other one. He's dead. And Bruce Willis comes up with this plan of sending the dead guy back down to the floor where everyone is held and where the terrorists are likely to be. And he is going to hide on the top part of the elevator. And he does this very intricate little plan of getting up onto the thing, of arranging the doors just so that he can do this. It's, you know, some good maneuvering here. He leaves a little message in blood on the European sweater.
Which is all the more ominous when read by Alan Rickman in that very slow method in just a few moments.
Ho, ho, ho. Yeah. But there was also the little moment of him not being able to put on the shoes, because they don't fit, which, of course, reinforces the fact that he doesn't have shoes, which will come up later, maybe.
Just in case you forgot.
Yeah.
9 million terrorists in the world. I got to kill one with feet smaller than my sister.
Yeah. His feet, there's no way that his feet were smaller than his sister.
No.
That was just not, it just had to be that way.
He was a very tall, blonde German man. I imagine he would have had at least the same size feet as Bruce Willis.
Yeah. It's just the way this movie works. From his vantage point through the grate in the elevator ceiling thing area, he's able to hear the terrorists talking about this, but he can't see them. So he doesn't know what Hans Gruber looks like. Only that they have a German accent, or he doesn't immediately identify it as German, but he identifies they have an accent. He estimates that they're European from their labels. He had also taken the walkie-talkie off of Carl's brother. And he makes his escape onto another elevator and up to the top floor, where he's going to use his purloined walkie-talkie to contact anybody who can hear him on a police channel from the highest point in the building.
Which gives us a great scene with the LAPD, where they're basically just saying, you're not allowed to use the radio. This is for cops only. And of course, he doesn't want to tip his hand that he's a cop because he doesn't want Hans to know that. But they're basically just telling him to stop reporting this horrible crime and go pick up a phone somewhere.
Yeah, she says that this is going to be like an FCC violation if he keeps doing it. He's like, fine.
Yeah, come down here. Arrest me. Just send people. It doesn't matter.
Yeah. And so this is what gets her to send the black and white.
The worst part is what gets her to finally send a cop car is the machine gun fire going off in the background of this call. Like, of all the things he said, maybe investigate it, but no, you gotta wait till like their eardrum is blown out from machine gun fire before they're like, fine, see if somebody can go drive by. It's like, oh, LAPD.
Well, this movie has this tension between the sort of the grunts, the flatfoots, the people on the ground, the people with the black and white cars, like between them and the upper management levels of organizations like the LAPD and the FBI. And so, of course, she is more of the upper management level. And when she says, you know, send over a black and white, and she's talking, they send that one car, and he's over at an AM/PM on Olympic picking up some Twinkies and stuff for his pregnant wife, and the cashier doesn't believe him, and they have the little exchange. He goes out to his car, and they tell him to go check out this thing, and he's like, all right, fine. And he drives up, cautiously. He says he
doesn't see anything. Is the one clever thing at the AMPM that I thought was interesting, that he's thinking about, like, I got to go check out what now over at this place? And he tosses the Twinkies in his car and actually walks out to the street because he can see the building from where he's standing. And you just see the flashing of the machine gun on top of the building. Like, all of these sorts of things are kind of building to, like, maybe there's something serious here. But no, they're not taking it all that seriously just yet.
Yeah. And so he drives his car over. He gets to the lobby. There's a little tension here where the lobby guy has to pretend that everything's cool and pretend that he's watching football and stuff. And like, oh, it's no big deal.
And I love that sort of like forced, like, nah, don't worry about it. Like, kind of flicks his hand behind his head, like, nah, go check it out or whatever. It's just like, you're so not a good actor right now, because he's supposed to be a bad actor in that instance. And then as soon as Reginald walks away, he kind of turns and gives him that evil Huey Lewis face.
Yeah. And yeah, he's like, oh yeah, you can go look around. And it's like, if he's not careful where he's looking, he's gonna be dead. But up on where Bruce Willis is, he has this plan of he's going to break the glass, and that he is going to use that to get the attention of the cop. One of the thugs comes after him there.
Yeah, unfortunately, apparently there's somebody on the roof who hears and or sees him smashing the glass and calls it in, and up come who this is Marco and I want to say Franco or no Marco and Heinrich come up to stop him, and they have their very tense moment of drop the gun, and the other guy sneaks up behind him and they shoot him, and he's chasing him underneath the table, and he says, next time you have a chance to shoot somebody, don't hesitate, and he blasts him through the table and says, thanks for the advice, in very typical John McClane fashion. Mm-hmm. And if I recall correctly, somewhere I read a story that since he was shooting off the blanks underneath that table, it was a very tight, confined space, and that little gun was right next to his head. I believe he went partially deaf in this movie because of that scene.
Oh, well, it was totally worth it. and then
because he throws Marco's body out the window onto the cop car.
Yeah. I should have done a little bit of, like, Marco, Polo. But anyway, he throws him out the window, lands on the cop car, and... Reginald Val Johnson appropriately freaks the crap out. And
they start blasting him with a fully automatic, like, chain-fed machine gun out the window, because I guess the thought from the terrorist was, like, if we can kill this cop really quick, he won't be able to call in the fact that somebody just threw a body onto his car, because they watched him call in and say, like, false alarm or whatever. I guess they have no idea what he actually said, but he's getting ready to leave, and they're like, well, he said everything's cool. If we can kill him before he says otherwise, we'll be okay. Otherwise, yeah. Like, why are you just firing 100 rounds of a machine gun out the window at this cop? That's not a great idea for, you know, hiding, but sure.
Well, no, but I think that was definitely the thing, is like, the jig is up.
Even though once Deputy Dwayne T. Robinson shows up, he's like, it's probably a stockbroker who got depressed and jumped off the building. And then there's just the guy who's calling you, who's shooting at you. It's like, really? That's the theory you came up with, Dwayne? Sure.
Yeah, well, he's supposed to be an idiot. But the Al Powell, of course, knows that, you know, stuff is going down here, and that this is an important situation, and reverses completely off of the plaza area and crashes his car.
And we get that great scene when he's driving backwards of Argyle, like, partying in the back of the limo, like, on the phone, and you can see the cop car driving backwards being pelted with bullets, and he's just like dancing, like, yeah, I can't hear anything, la da da.
Yeah. And it's one of those things where if you're watching this for the first time, you're like, why do we keep cutting back to Argyle? And it's like, well, this will come in to play later, so calm down. You know, nothing's really wasted in this thing, with all these multi threads being woven through here. That happens. He calls it in. They send a bunch of people. The police lieutenant shows up, and he's taking charge now.
Well, and of course, at the same time that Al Powell calls it in, is when William Atherton hears it over the radio while he's talking to his lady friend, and tries to get a jump on everyone by clearly being a horrible human being and just doing whatever he can to get a news van so he can go cover the story.
Yeah, well, I love it. Doesn't come into play later on, but it sets up how ruthless and self-centered he is, that he basically walks into a live set and just you know, start shouting at everybody.
And he pisses off, like, the main guy who's about to go on camera.
Yeah.
Harvey Johnson.
Yeah, I love that little exchange they have. And he's so angry.
Eat it, Harvey, yeah. Which apparently is something that would make people angry in 1988.
I don't know. I mean, if you say eat it, somebody, then I think it would set off a nerve, depending on the intonation. And maybe I'm assuming they have some past tension. And so the scene unfolds where he gets his van and he's going to go check it out. And he arrives, of course, when the LAPD are securing the area with his little police van off to the side.
Oh, crap. We forgot my favorite line. My favorite line. Throwing the body out under the car. Welcome to the party, pal. Oh, God. It's like, here's your entrance to the Christmas party, pal. I'm going to throw a dead body under your car and you're going to get shot at.
Yeah.
That has reestablished the tone of what this movie is going to be. And here we go, second act.
Yeah. And with everything that unfolds here, Hans is not super concerned because he feels like they have the situation under control, that the police were going to come into his plan anyways at a certain point just later on. So he feels like as long as they can manage the situation, as long as they can keep John McClane contained, not necessarily go looking for him, and as long as they can keep the LAPD from getting inside the building, then they will have successfully defended themselves so that they can finish everything off. He's very calm and collected about it. Carl is, of course, still upset and, like, hitting things because he's having his temper tantrum about his dead brother. Carl wants to go, you know, like, hunt down McClane and, like, drink his blood and stuff. But
yeah, Hans is super calm, and they're laying out the fact that this is part of the plan right up until the moment where Bruce Willis decides to grab the walkie-talkie off of the dead Heinrich along with the detonators and very gingerly poke the bear with some silly commentary by sassing him and telling him basically that he knows everyone's names because, you know, again, he found them while he was hiding on the elevator and he heard everybody. And it just kind of sort of lay out like, hey, I know what you're doing down there and I'm not going to let it happen. And then, of course, one of my other, it's a single word, but I love just the way he goes, whoa, once he finds the detonators in that bag. And and when he tells the dead guy, these are very bad for you, when he takes his cigarettes from him.
Yeah. And well, that was some of the like anti-politically correctness of the, you know, like, cigarettes, you know, screw you, liberal hippies.
It's just like the most smartass John McClane dialogue that we can get in this entire movie, just crammed into that scene where it's like, even in the face of all of this, once he comes face to face with the head bad guy, he's not going to take it seriously. He's going to talk about how much he liked Roy Rogers and sequin shirts, and he's just going to try and piss off Hans and go about his day of ruining their whole plot.
Yeah, but I liked Roy Rogers, but I liked the bacon cheeseburger at Roy Rogers. It was slightly different.
I think you're thinking of a different Roy Rogers.
I thought it was the same guy.
It may have been, but right, different context. Anyway,
but it was food. Food is always our context.
Well, our context, not John McClane's necessarily.
No, he must be feeling pretty lightheaded by the end of this with the blood loss, and he hasn't eaten anything. I mean, he got off that long flight. Who knows what they fed him on the plane?
Yeah, you never know. And another thing I love about this particular scene is where Alan Rickman is accusing him of being just another American who's seen too many movies. And, like, for me, Die Hard is the movie that would turn me into this kind of guy. I'm the American who saw Die Hard too many times. So that's who he's accusing John McClane of being.
No movie would ever turn me into John McClane. I would be one of the cowering extras in the back of every scene. And then just run away at the end.
That's fine.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they would have brought a couch out for you too, or you could have like bunked in with the pregnant woman that they bring the couch out for.
Mm-hmm. They have their little exchange where they talk to each other for the first time and they trade stuff. And this is, of course, where we get the iconic line, yippee-ki-yay, mother and this iconic line is, of course, repeated everywhere, forever, in every circumstance possible, for any reason you can imagine. even the terrible ADR dubs of which I assume Dan will probably sprinkle several into this episode.
Oh God, I don't want to go find them.
where it's like, yippee-ki-yay, mother lover, whatever. Like all the terrible things where they had to edit this to go on TV.
In Die Hard 2, I know for certain it's yippee-ki-yay, Mr. Falcon. In Die Hard 3, I believe it's yippee-ki-yay, Melon Farmer. Or no, they use Melon Farmer a lot just in the context of other words that are start with M and F. But I don't know if it's yippee-ki-yay, Melon Farmer. They just call each other Melon Farmers a lot, which I thought was actually kind of hilarious.
Yeah, you're my favorite Melon Farmer. Anyway, they have the ridiculousness here where this line, this good in this movie line.
Only used twice in this movie and in every Die Hard sequel and just eternally quoted because why not? Even though he's using it just sort of to sass Hans, who keeps calling him a cowboy. And it's not John McClane's signature line. He's just like he's trying to, again, piss Hans off by just, you know, everything he says, he's got a smart remark back to him.
Mm-hmm. Real-time follow-up. Roy yes. Rogers is the chain's namesake.
Yes.
And it's the same guy.
Okay. But okay. They were talking about the guy, not necessarily the restaurant.
I know, but I'm talking about the restaurant.
I don't think I've ever been to one.
You wouldn't have been, because most of them were bought by Hardee's. There's a couple that still operate, I think, in New York.
Was it a Florida thing or was it a California thing?
Maryland. I used to live briefly in Rockville, Maryland.
Yes, as explored in the Lost Defocus episodes.
Mm-hmm. Lost.
Anyway.
Burgers.
The pivotal scene where Holly comes in and sort of, just like her husband, kind of gives Hans some sass about how she's now in charge because he's the idiot who killed her boss. And the main thing that comes out of this is we get that she's trying to play up her cover of being Miss Gennaro, which it says on the door. So, you know, I guess he buys it. But again, being smart characters, the thing that I love about this scene is you can see her looking over at the picture that she turned down of Bruce Willis because she was kind of annoyed that he hadn't called. And just even that brief look, Hans notices it and realizes there's something more to it. And he turns around as if trying to figure out what's going on here. Something's odd with this woman. And yet he gets distracted when she says Ms. Gennaro and he looks away like just an instant before he would have noticed the downed photo that would have given the whole thing away.
Yeah. Well, but what I like here is she's not gung-ho about this. She's playing it very cool, very calm, very collected. She's not trying to provoke him. She's really doing a very good job here of trying to keep the situation manageable.
Because, she's in charge, but she knows that she would instantly be bait for John if he found out because she knows John is up there killing bad guys because she saw Carl's brother come down and she knows that it was John just instinctively. And she's like, well, I got to kind of look out for all the employees because I'm in charge now, but I really don't want to tip my hat because then I'm just going to be a hostage.
Yeah. And which makes it all the more ridiculous that she talks to Ellis about this. God. But
well, I mean, I guess
Farmer Ellis. God,
I guess of all of the sins in this movie, it's underestimating the stupidity of Ellis is the one that sort of causes the whole thing to spiral a bit out of control.
Yeah, and William Atherton, but you can't do anything about him. With the whole thing, you know, he seems reasonable. That he's going to let them, you know, use the bathroom, and he's going to bring out a couch. So he's willing to negotiate with her on that, just because he wants to keep them calm so that they don't interfere internally anymore with any of the plans that they have.
Yeah, and what does Gruber care? Because they're not part of the plan. He's just here to execute. He's a professional. He's a thief. And it's like, whatever, as long as you guys are quiet and out of my way, I don't care what you do. Take a couch. Who cares?
Yeah, and then he just blows them up at the end is the plan.
Right. That is one thing that I often forget. Like, the plan is to actually detonate 30 people with C4 explosives on top of this building in a horrible, horrible death.
Yeah, he's not a nice guy. But we don't know this as part of the movie yet. We don't really fully understand his escape plan.
We have seen them setting up the C4 on that very steamy, boilery type room that's on the top floor of the Nakatomi Plaza, apparently. But we're not entirely certain why.
Yeah, we don't know what his plan is for using that, and how everything will come about. And we, of course, for this part, have a couple scenes with Theo, and like he's still, you know, turning through locks, and he keeps reminding him, like, "Oh, the last one. I can't do anything about the last one," which is important because he Gruber's got a plan for that. But he does need the detonators, and you know, John McClane's not sure why he needs the detonators. He hasn't figured that part of the puzzle out yet. From his limited vantage point, but he's gonna. Of course we get some of the tension, down with the police guys and
the idiotic cops who try and sneak in. I love that you can immediately tell how dumb they are from two things. They go sneaking through rose bushes and start going like, ow, 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 because they keep getting poked by roses. And then Dwayne likes to instigate the cops and, you know, give the go code he gives them is kick ass. Like, please, come on, man.
Yeah. It was not a good idea.
And then they send in the car. Like, the guy who's in charge of, like, the SWAT-type team, he should have been fired because, like, he made three decisions in the span of, like, 2 minutes, and they were all terrible.
Well, yeah, and you know you're in a bad situation when even even Gleason's character is like, oh, we should pull them back. And the guy's like, no, they're too far in. And it's like, wait a minute, SWAT guy. The idiot even says that you should get out of there. So you're even an even bigger idiot than this idiot. And sure enough, he is. And the car, of course, explodes with this very dramatic setup scene with the missile launcher, where everything has been hand stenciled with exactly what it is for mm-hmm. how to assemble your missile launcher. They fire one round into it, and the guys need to get out of the situation, and it's really bad. And then, of course, Gruber says to fire another round, and this really angers McClane, who's like, "No, you don't have to do that. Like, you don't need to do that." And Gruber's like, fire. Like, I don't care. And he blows it up some more. McClane has, of course, the idea to take the C4, wedge it onto a rolling desk chair between a CRT monitor and wrap some power cord around it, and then roll it down the elevator shaft. And it explodes quite spectacularly and blows out the whole lower floor of the building.
Phenomenal scene.
Yes. And what I really love about this is the aftermath of it, with Gleason's character yelling at John McClane about how all of his guys are covered in glass right now.
Yes. He starts up the conversation. John McClane is like kind of disdainful about the whole thing. He's like, hey, is the building on fire? And the response is, no, but it's going to need a paint job and a shitload of screen doors. And then, of course, Dwayne Robinson decides to yell at him. He's like, I've got 100 people down here, and they're all covered in glass. Glass? Who gives a shit about glass? Like, every single part of this back and forth after that is just an eternally quotable line that I love so much. But, yeah, you can see how Mr. Robinson's priorities are a little backwards.
Yeah, and you can definitely get that Mr. McTiernan has a disdain for authority. So the whole thing unfolds. The next scene after this.
Well, I didn't write anything down. My next note is Ellis trying to weasel his way out by giving them John and pretending that he's his buddy. And again, another one of my favorite lines is once Ellis adjusts his suit and buttons his shirt again, the way he addresses the terrorists is Spreckensy talk. Like, you're such a terrible, terrible person because you have no idea what you're about to walk into. And that's the way you like to broach this conversation. But I love Spreckensy talk. It's a good one.
Well, I just love what he does, like the shoulders hunching, you know, like the hands gesturing. It's so used car salesman business guy.
I love when he gets the close up once he's in the chair in Gruber's office, when he does that smile that is so utterly rehearsed and inauthentic that it's just like, that's why you got cast, because you can make that smile.
Mm-hmm.
I love in this scene, along with our guy on the opening scene, Gruber's just kind of like nodding his head. And I love the line that you're very perceptive, just his way of blowing off the fact that Ellis has no idea what's going on. It's just like, what are you doing here now?
He's just, oh, God, Ellis, just Ellis. But what I love is that Hans allows him to think he has the upper hand, that he plays off of this idiot. that he's just like, oh, sure, yeah, I'm just going to use you, you complete moron, because you think you have this situation in control because you misunderstand what is happening here. And he uses this, of course, against McClane, because Ellis makes the mistake of telling Hans that they are old friends, and that if he just comes down and gives him the detonators and stuff, then everything will be fine. And McClane, while not really liking Ellis, is like, no, you why did you do that? Don't tell him that you're my friend. This is a really terrible idea.
I want to know what was going on inside Ellis's head. Like, as soon as he talks to Hans and he goes, okay, here's the deal. I need my detonators back. And that's what John has. What's clicking in Ellis's head to go, okay, all we have to do is get the detonators back. It's like, wait a minute, a bag of detonators? That doesn't sound like this is going to end peaceably. So maybe I should slowly back out of this office and be like, you know what? Sorry, I kind of messed this one up. But like, he's just in too deep from the moment he makes that initial call that it's like, what are you going to die now? And it's going to be Ellis.
What I really love is when he's like, Ellis, you shouldn't be doing this. And he's like, tell me about it. All right, John, listen. They want you to tell them where the detonators are. They know people are listening. They want the detonators or they're going to kill me. And he acts like this is fake. Like, they're not actually going to kill him. And he like is winking with Hans. He's like, oh, yeah. You know, like, you're not, like, kill me. Ha ha. And he's like pouring the Coke and stuff. And of course, he is actually going to kill him.
He's got the line, what is this? Is this radio, not TV? What am I, a method actor? Because he pulls out the gun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he dies. He
gets shot in the face while drinking a Coke.
Yeah. Good job, Ellis. You complete.
And the moral of the story is that Coke is detrimental to your health, both kinds, apparently.
Yeah, but because of Ellis blathering on and identifying John McClane, this enables everybody else to be complete idiots, including William Atherton, who is able to send somebody to find information on McClane, and to find out more specifically the location of his wife's address in Los Angeles so that they can go drive their van over there later.
Naturally, since he's a scummy reporter, he's going to cruise over there and interview their, what, like, 4-year-old daughter on national television saying, like, hey, kids, your parents are being held by terrorists. What would you like to say to them? It's like, you despicable bastard.
Oh, not just that. Remember, he threatens the housekeeper that he's going to call INS on her if he doesn't get to talk to the kids. He's like, oh, yeah, and I just want to talk, so it's not really that big of a deal. It's not really worth it for you. Like, he's just a complete asshole. There is no other way to describe it. Like, he's just the worst human being. Because while the other people are in this to steal money and stuff, he's just in this to get a story. And through his actions, he really screws the pooch for everybody. Because this is what gets us the news broadcast later on, but I'm kind of skipping ahead with that, where we actually see the kid on TV, and Hans sees this on the little portable CRT TV inside the office and pieces together everything about...
Yeah, Gennaro. Because Holly sees that broadcast, and she's just... so overcome with emotion that she can't keep her face straight while Hans notices that she's staring right at that TV going, oh, crap. And, of course, you hear William Atherton over the broadcast say, is there something you'd like to say to your mother and father? And she's like, because presumably he looked around the office and he saw that there are pictures of her with her kids. And it's like, oh, great. Thanks for giving that away, Mr. Thornburg.
Yeah, well, he had already seen the pictures of the kids, yeah. But he didn't see the picture of McClane. So... When we go through this and we have the cuts here back and forth between Holly and Hans figuring this out and looking around the office, seeing the other photos, picking up the one that's been turned over with the picture of John McClane, this is what lets him know that he has the upper hand here now, that he has a piece of information that he can use against McClane to get him to knock it off and presumably get the detonators back.
Right. And it is worth pointing out that, yes, since we skipped ahead, this is because Hans does know what John McClane looks like, because after they shoot Ellis, they've got to make up for some lost time, and he decides to go check up on the roof explosives himself because, well, you know, more people have died now, and he's got to get his hands dirty for a minute. So he has his little scene where, with his terrible American accent, where John McClane comes face to face with him.
Yeah, and he pretends that he's an escaped hostage. And he's like, oh, no, don't shoot me. You're one of those guys. And I don't know what it is. It's like a I don't know how to describe that accent he does or the weird warbling.
It's like English for Texas or something. I can't even really put my finger on it either. It's just he draws out the words really long. And then there's Bill Clay is his name. I can't even that's my accent doing his accent doing a Texan is terrible.
Yeah, well, Texas is terrible. You hear that, Matt Alexander, British person in Texas who doesn't listen to this episode, so it's fine.
wait. Did we just conflate Matt Alexander with Hans Gruber?
Yeah, sure, why not?
Okay.
Could be worse. At least we didn't say it was Carl. And so we go through the whole shtick here, and this is actually kind of effective, where... we're not sure whether or not McClane fully trusts him, but we do know that McClane's not just going to out and out shoot him right now. And we get the tension here where we're not sure if Hans will be discovered. And sure enough, McClane hands Hans a handgun, after loading it, quote-unquote loading it, and then turns his back to Hans as they're going to walk away. And of course, Hans seizes on this opportunity to use the handgun against McClane. And he picks up his walkie-talkie, confident that he has the upper hand, and calls in the goons. And then he goes to threaten McClane that he's going to pull the trigger unless McClane puts down the gun. And of course, we come to find out that McClane didn't actually load the handgun that he gave to Hans Gruber because he's not a total moron. Unfortunately, before McClane is able to take down Gruber here, the elevator door opens with all the goons and they spill out and there's gunfire everywhere. one key thing, though, is that Hans sees that McClane doesn't have any shoes. And he is able to come up with his little strategy of shooting out all of the glass in the computer room with the ridiculous lights. I mean, seriously.
The gigantic server room. I love it. There's like the giant servers that are in their own glass rooms. Then there's the giant terminals that are larger than any desk you've ever seen.
Yeah. And there's the big boxes that say control on the side. And then there's like this dome with like disco lights inside of it. Like, I can't explain what any of this stuff is supposed to be doing, but it's just like strobing, blinking stuff. And it's just like computers and technology. And they blow up everything here, which one must assume that none of this is important, I guess. And
oh, you mean to the vault operations below?
Yeah. Or to the building. And since everything's computer controlled, I assume those computers are somewhere else. And maybe these are the ones that they run the local Office Word Perfect or Lotus Notes out of or something. And they lay waste to everything. And Hans tells them to blow out the glass because he knows that John doesn't have any shoes. And this is actually very clever because John doesn't have any shoes and he cuts up his feet, something fierce. And this is where we also get another one of those scenes with the fake out of like, oh, is he behind the thing? Oh, he's not behind the thing. I don't know.
It's dramatic tension, Joe. It's okay.
But it gets a little old because then by this point in the film, I don't expect him to be behind the thing whenever they go to look.
Well, every single time it's a different instance. You know, there's one time he's just hiding behind drywall. And, oh, he doesn't really have anywhere to go. All the bright lights are on. How's he going to sneak away? But he snuck away. And this one, is he really going to risk sprinting across the glass to get out of there? He's going to tear himself up bad. I mean, he's got a dead body laying in front of him who went through the plate glass and is just bleeding profusely. And he's looking right at that going like, that's about to be my feet. Am I going to sprint across this or am I going to just try and hold out and defend my position? And naturally we see that, he yanks the detonator bag off to try and like sort through it to see if there are any more magazines for the stolen MP5. And he runs out of bullets. And he's like, well, no more options, so I guess I'm sprinting through some glass.
Yeah, and well, but we also get the before when this guy crashed through the plate glass and hit the ground, we had this amazingly gory scene of
his knees exploding.
Oh God, why did we need to see that in such slow motion detail?
They put a few dozen squibs in there, didn't they?
I think they used all of the squibs on the planet Earth, because Paul Verhoeven saw this and was like, wow, that's a little much, because there was just blood and gore everywhere, it was totally not,
to be fair, there's a lot of blood and gore when they shoot Takagi. We just see it from the outside of a room, so it kind of just splatters against glass, but yeah, if you're looking right at that, there is a whole hell of a lot of blood that comes flying out of his legs.
Yeah, it's a little much. And so they, but this is of course where then Carl goes and he uses his flashbang grenade, and then he rushes into the space, and of course he's gone because he ran through the glass. They're like, well, screw this, we got the detonators, that's all we really need. And then of course Johnson & Johnson are gonna solve our problems here, and they don't, and they make everything terrible.
They have a very serious introduction when they're both walking up. They both have, you know, very serious faces, almost on par with Gruber's, like, very slow, long walk introduction to where they, you know, come up to the top of that hill of dirt, and they're, you know, basically being introduced and saying they're taking over. You know, he ends the scene on not anymore, when, you know, we're talking about who's in charge, and it's like, all right, we finally got the serious characters that are going to be the tactical counterpart of Gruber, and it's like, nope, not so much.
I never thought for one second when I saw this before or since that these people were going to solve anything. It is very clear that the theme here is that one lone guy against all the odds can change the world, and that all the bumbling bureaucracy in the world will just ruin everything. That is the major theme here. Merry Christmas. And so the whole thing with Johnson & Johnson, my favorite part of their introduction is, of course, the no relation comment.
And then later when he's on the phone, the no, the other one, it's like, what does it make a difference which Johnson you're talking to? They're basically on the same team, but anyway.
Yeah, I mean, they're basically interchangeable in terms of their dialogue and mannerisms and everything.
They're a walking punchline, basically.
Yeah, I mean, they're kind of a joke. The whole thing happens. Of course, Reginald Val Johnson's concerned. He's like, oh, you know, everything's gone to shit here, and he's talking to John McClane over the walkie-talkie about how bad things are.
Another one of my favorite lines. They open that scene with, you know, hey, how's it going? And he's pulling the glass out of his feet. And I don't know why I love the line so much, but all things being equal, I'd rather be in Philadelphia. Like, I don't know what that means or why he says it, but I love it.
Philadelphia is terrible. Well, I assume he's saying
it's probably better than having glass jammed into your feet.
Yeah, marginally. But with the thing with saying that is he also might still be thinking that people don't know that he's from New York yet. So maybe he doesn't want to say, you know, that he wishes he was in New York.
I thought he got outed on the phone or on the walkie-talkie when he's talking to Ellis, when he calls him Officer John McClane of the NYPD.
Oh, I don't remember him saying that. But anyway, Philadelphia, crap. And so the important part here is that he's in this bathroom. He's in his lowest low. He's licking his wounds. Well, not really licking his wounds, because that'd be disgusting.
Be very gross.
It is a metaphor. metaphor. And so he's talking to Al, and he needs to get his mind off of this. And so he's pressing Al for some personal information. And this is unfortunately where we find out the reason why Al works a desk is that he shot a kid who he thought had a ray gun in the dark at night when he was a rookie. And this did not get him off the force. Now, they didn't say whether or not the kid died. I'm going to kind of hope that the kid didn't die, but that's a little dark for his backstory here. Especially since his redemption at the end of the movie is that he does end up shooting somebody, so then it's kind of like, well, okay. But Anyway,
well, for a cop, he's finally on the side of right and doing what he's supposed to be doing. But yeah, that is a bit precarious there, that he redeems himself by killing someone. But the thing I like about this is, like, how far into the movie are we now at this point? And we're getting a character's backstory just now, and yet it somehow doesn't feel contrived. Like, it feels like the kind of thing, you know, the part that I quibble with is the fact that John McClane would be spilling his guts about anything over the walkie-talkie that we know is kind of like something public that everyone can hear. But let's just assume that he feels like he's really kind of screwed, like he's probably going to die because he now can't walk and he's bleeding profusely. So he's willing to just like, I need a moment to talk. And this is where this whole thing comes out. But like that conversation is, it felt real and it felt emotional. And I love that he even says, like, you know, because he understands being a cop, what it all meant, that he feels terrible for bringing it up. And they have a closer relationship now after having shared that information.
Yeah, and it's just a little problematic. I do agree that it doesn't throw me off of the movie here that this exposition has come at this point. But the exposition itself is just a little strange, especially in light of what happens later in the film. But the thing we come to realize here is that the plan of turning off the power is exactly what Hans wants. Because this allows them to disable the power in a non-local way, which will enable them to get past the final lock on the vault that was impenetrable up till now. So obviously the detonators weren't for that. Quel surprise. And so they go to use the stupid Johnson guys, order the power guy to turn it off, and they're all arguing. And they use their by-the-book force to demand that it be off.
This is one instance where I can't remember which version of the movie I saw this on, because I now own four. But there's a deleted scene here where they do shut off the power just to the building. And it annoys Gruber because it doesn't undo the lock. So he tells Theo to use his little hacking skills to turn some lights back on because they shut down just the building, but he taps into the emergency power to relight the building up. And it irritates the FBI guys so much that then they go and say, fine, shut down the entire city grid. And that's what finally opens the vault, which I'm glad they deleted that scene. And you see the FBI guys just like, go way over the top immediately abusing their power and just shutting down, you know, the 10 city blocks, because just that little extra back and forth with upping the stakes didn't really add anything. And that's a great instance where the editing made the point much more concise.
Yeah. Of course, after they do this is when they go to make their call. Well, not call on the walkie-talkie to talk to the captors to find out what their demands are now that they have them, you know, off their game. They're going to let them sweat it out. Idiots. This is where Gruber makes up his insane demands for the helicopters to come on their way to the roof to pick up people. McClane, of course, is cowering in the bathroom still, and then he figures out, well, what the hell did they want on... What was he doing on the roof that was so important? What was the big deal up on the roof? And he's like, there's got to be some reason. He's suspicious of this, and so he's limping with his dirty shirt tied around his foot up to the top floor to figure it all out. And meanwhile, everyone's on the wild goose chase of organizing the military choppers to come in, and it's all just insanity. Unfortunately, when Bruce Willis sees that the entire roof is lined with C4, he is unable to really make this point clear to anyone because he is immediately accosted by our friend Carl.
He probably should have been a little more discreet when he was walking around up in that room, like yelling out loud to himself, "What were you doing up here, Hans?" Like, maybe be a little quiet in case somebody's still up there looking around for you, but he kind of gives him his position away, and Carl walks up and shoves his giant Steyr-Aug right in Bruce Willis's face.
Yes. Not John McClane's brightest moment. This is unfortunate, because then we have a very prolonged fight here with them. and all the hostages are being rounded up to go up onto the roof, and the choppers are flying in all low on the deck so that they can't see that they're attack copters. This is all transpiring. Of course, we know that John McClane's on a timer here because he's got to disable this or get the people off the roof or something. He's got to warn them. And he's stuck fighting Carl. And they have a very big fight, which culminates in Carl being strangled to death, quote-unquote, with a chain in a very, 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 very serious way. And he's super, super dead-looking. And
yeah, he goes from moving to not moving really quick.
Yeah, and you know, someone might argue that he's playing possum, but I wouldn't argue that. I would say he's dead. And I would say that the part where he comes back to life at the end of the movie, kind of nonsensical and unnecessary.
Well, he certainly didn't die from the hanging in the traditional sense, whereby his neck would have been broken, because he didn't actually take much of a fall. He was just kind of asphyxiated by the choking. So it is... Well, depending on how compressed the timeline, it is conceivable that the paramedics, once they came in, couldn't tell the difference between him and a hostage and decided to resuscitate him, presuming that maybe there was still some life in him. They didn't know how long he was hanging. Who knows how long he was hanging in actual screen time or whatever. But that would be my only guess. Although the problem with that is then once he kicks his medical blanket off, he has a machine gun underneath. So he was apparently resuscitated, and then a blanket was put around him, and then he found his gun to hide underneath it.
I think it's dumb. Anyway, so...
Well, you know, everybody else gets redeemed. Why not Al?
Because I think it's a sort of an awkward redemption, because his redemption is that he shoots and kills the bad guy, but does that mean that it was okay that he shot and killed... or shot and injured or whatever somebody else earlier? Like, is that what this redemption is?
No. It's that he's been too scared to really do the job of a police officer, and he's been sort of thrown back into the field with his new partner, and they called each other partner numerous times over the radio. And when it comes down to it, he has to step up and actually defend his partner as a real partner would. So he does his job, and he's gotten over his mistake, as he talks about over the radio when they're talking. He doesn't know how to deal with his mistake. That's one thing that they never teach you in the academy.
Yeah, when you're a rookie. Anyway, so he... but, of course, before we get to that point, there's the big scenes here of everyone being overjoyed with all the bearer bonds, with Theo going down to the ambulance and Argyle finally getting some action.
This is the one shot in the movie that always throws me a little bit. Like, once the vault opens and they're going through everything to take a look at everything that they're going to get, the camera goes down the line of like a shelf of stuff, and then it turns 90 degrees so you can see a painting that's sort of like held up against the wall, but it turns 90 degrees so you can look at the painting properly, not like... because the painting is on its side or whatever. Like, why was that necessary? It felt really odd to me, and it always feels odd to me when I see it, but that's the only one.
Yeah, anyway. Not super huge, but Argyle punches out Theo, which is great, because Theo's a jerk. Argyle decides that he's going to bust out of the barrier now, barricade now, that has locked him into the garage with the limo.
Hang on. We're going to skip right over the Hans out the window scene?
No. I'm not skipping to it. I was just processing these things in sort of a logical order, because we're not going to cut back and forth between all this stuff.
We can do it. I'll say cut to, and then you can say it, and then I'll say cut to again. Cut to. Interior. Vault. Night. Continued.
Fade to black. and so the whole thing, that unfolds, and then with... Bruce Willis and Hans Gruber, we have the final big showdown. And Holly is, of course, involved in this final big showdown. He's going to go get her. They're going to get out of there. Everything's gone to crap because the thing exploded up on the roof, and it was a pretty big fireball.
The building is on fire and raining printer paper all over the place.
I don't understand. Was there a vault full of printer paper, blank? Printer paper? Reams of blank printer paper are falling out of this building.
Well, you know, since it's a Christmas movie and it's in LA, they had to do something akin to snowing at the end of the movie when the credits roll. So really the closest they could get is snowing white and green blank paper.
Yeah. Anyway, so they have their scene here, their big final scene, where Gruber is going to kill Holly, if McClane stands in his way.
Yes, and we've seen just a moment ago, before, I mean, he knows where Holly is, and he's trying to get his stuff together and plan it out. He's down to 2 bullets left in his pistol and none left in his machine gun, but he's gonna use the machine gun as a prop to scare him, to have their little standoff and trick him in a very clever way, a very Gruber-esque plan.
Which would have worked out very poorly for him if they had not also thought that they would, you know, like, have this unfold this way. If he had just turned the corner and then somebody had shot at him, then he would just be dead.
I think he was betting on Gruber's general demeanor of pontificating a bit. So he kind of probably assumed that the scene wasn't going to go down without some sort of a speech.
Yeah, well, good for him. And of course, he has the uncomfortable scene of taping the Merry Christmas packaging tape for his Beretta onto his back, which will probably hurt like a lot later. He doesn't seem to mind, though, but I guess, you know, with all the pain everywhere else on his body, that this is small potatoes. And they have the whole thing with the standoff here, the dead last henchman, and he's got one bullet left. And he, you know, gets Holly to jump out of the way for a second so he can shoot Hans. He doesn't kill Hans, but he wounds him severely, enough where Hans falls out the window and sort of drags Holly along. Now, I think it's a little silly that Hans is holding on to the gold Rolex that the company gave her. That's a little heavy on the artistic symbolism there of the company, and yes. He needs to undo the latch of the company, and
a little, but it's such an iconic shot, and then the slow motion and Gruber with the hair that comes flying up, and he goes fallen. But I love the way the scene plays out, because there's so much attention paid to Holly's reaction. You know, when he throws down the machine gun as Gruber demands, like, you see the despair on her face, like, oh God, we're screwed and my husband's going to die and then so am I. And then she slowly starts to realize that there was more to the plan, because Gruber's gun comes away from her face and he's getting ready to shoot John. And at that moment, she kind of gets like a hint of what's going to happen. And then she looks to John and they have a little bit of eyes, and he yells her name and she dips. And then he nails Huey Lewis right in the forehead and Gruber right in the chest. And boom, he blows the smoke off his gun. And what does he say? Is that the happy trails, Hans?
Yes, I believe so. And it's just a little silly that he falls out the window to his death, because by this point in the 80s, a lot of people had fallen off of a lot of things to their death at the end of every movie. It was such a big trope back then. This is not like the first time this was ever done. So we can't say like, oh, well, Die Hard did it first and better. Like, no. This happened quite frequently.
Well, it's not like he was just straight thrown out the window. There was the drama of him trying to pull the Holly with him and holding on.
Yeah, but I know. But, you know, Ronnie Cox as the OCP senior president, Dick Jones, he falls out the window. Fortunately, Hans Gruber is not like a little stop motion with weird arms person. We have, Commander Krug from Star Trek III, and he falls and there's a lightning flash and he turns into a little stop motion guy. So fortunately they didn't do the stop motion thing. So we can say that Die Hard successfully dropped somebody off of a building and cut away before they had to cut to stop motion, because that looks terrible.
Yeah. The landing pad was behind some trees or whatever. We were watching it from Powell and Robinson's perspective. And of course, idiot Chief Robinson says, I hope that's not a hostage.
Yeah.
Like of all the things, like, doesn't really matter who it is. Somebody's dying as they're being thrown out a window. But sure, let's try and basically he's looking out for his job. Like, I don't want any hostages to die. So fingers crossed, it's not a hostage.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he does care in a way later on because when McClane comes out of the building with Holly and all the other hostages are running out, and they are going over, the police chief walks over to him and he's like, "Oh, you have any idea what a mess you've made, all the trouble you've caused, and like you killing all these people, like didn't have to be like this, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera." And he's going on and on and on about it. And it's like, of course he doesn't quite get it that, you know, this, that he's a moron, and that all of this has unfolded, because he couldn't actually manage the situation at all, and that John McClane had to take charge. And if it wasn't for him, things would be a lot worse.
Yeah. And if I recall, doesn't John like get ready to kind of punch him, and then that's when Carl pops out with the machine gun?
Yeah. This is also the part where we get the music cue from Aliens, with James Horner music blaring. I think it is so strange every time I watch it. It just sticks out like a sore thumb, that the director specifically did not like the music that Michael Kamen, the composer for the rest of the film, had scored for this part. And so he pulls in this music cue from Aliens, a big, huge, recognizable movie with a very specific music format.
This is the kind of lovey sounding one when him and Powell do their hugging together.
Well, it starts off with a little like a bit of the sort of like Saccharine Ripley stuff, but then it goes to the like big bombastic action-y stuff from it. I think it's, I can't remember if it's exactly Resolution in Hyperspace or if it's one of the other music cues, but it's one of those things at the end of Aliens where stuff's hitting the fan. And of course stuff is hitting the fan, because there's Carl and he's going to kill him now, and Powell shoots him. But it's one of those things that I just find incredibly distracting. I don't know why that it was so important to do this instead of whatever Kamen had done, or to ask Kamen to do something else. Kamen didn't seem to mind because he came back for a number two. Whereas James Horner, when he was heavily edited by James Cameron for that same movie, for Aliens, when he was edited by him, he never worked with Cameron again until Titanic, and Cameron had to go find other people, like Alan Silvestri did Abyss. So
Well, I'm glad you're here to shed some light on that, because I didn't recognize the song, and I don't really care. It's probably more dramatic than what was in there originally, because they felt the need to punch up that if the music didn't kind of parallel the ridiculous, oh crap, we're back in an action scene moment with Carl with his gun, it would probably seem a little, well, it would probably seem really out of place. It already seems a little out of place, but it probably wouldn't have worked nearly as well if the music didn't kind of match that, the stakes are back up real quick, and Powell's going to have his redemption moment.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like the Michael Kamen score was incredibly impressive, but it had a certain style and stuff, so to just see it like completely thrown out the window for this other thing is just silly.
That is true. I will say that the score of this movie, I couldn't tell you what it is off the top of my head, but when I hear it, I recognize it, and I think it fits the movie really well.
Yeah, and a lot of it has to do with playing over and over again Beethoven's Ninth Symphony.
Ah, yes.
Yeah.
That's in there a couple times. It's in the vault scene, and where else?
It's at the end of the movie, too. A few spots, and then there's a little bit of like Bach's Brandenburg Concerto number 3 and some other stuff. Like there's just sort of a random assortment of things, but the Beethoven's Ninth Symphony thing is pretty iconic for the film because it's sort of tied to Gruber.
Yeah, you know what, now that you said that, you've reminded me that I'm pretty sure it was used in the trailer for Die Hard 5, and that makes me all the more offended by Die Hard 5.
I'm sorry.
But yep. So Carl is killed with 6 bullets, which is good because that's all that Al Powell had in his gun, I believe, right? I mean, did he use all 6? He has a revolver, so he I don't know what he was planning to do when he whipped around and saw Argyle coming through the fence, because he was probably out of bullets with his old revolver there. But yep, he takes down Carl. Argyle comes out to pick up John McClane with his delightful Argyle sensibility, saying, "This is your idea of Christmas. I can't wait to see New Year."
Yeah.
And we have the wonderful slowly driving away scene to Let It Snow while it's snowing paper all over this destroyed plaza.
Mm-hmm.
God, I love this movie.
Okay.
Spectacular. Every bit of it.
Mm-hmm.
There are so many great lines, so many great moments that have been ripped off for a million years. Oh, that song.
It's not a song. It's a score.
Yeah, so, yeah, okay, I know what that part is. That's when he's shooting Carl, and Carl's not going down with, like, the first four hits. And it's the very dramatic dramatic moment where we get that super narrow depth of field rack focus reveal that it is, while everyone else bit the dust, that's Sergeant Al Pal who drew his revolver and saved his partner.
Yeah, just like, you know, the alien queen was really on the side of the dropship and stuff. Anyway, so it's...
So what we really want is a supercut of Sergeant Al Pal versus the alien.
Versus the alien queen?
Yeah. So who do you think would win that?
I'm going to guess the alien queen.
38 special versus the alien queen? Probably. It's probably a safe bet.
Yeah, if only he knew how to operate a loader, then he'd be safe.
Yeah, no, probably not so much. He spends a lot of time around the desk eating Twinkies, so I don't think he has a lot of experience with heavy equipment.
Hey, be nice. Those are for his pregnant wife.
Right. Well, he does know all of the ingredients to the 1,000-year-old Twinkie that Bruce Willis eats, so we could probably presume that he's eaten one or two in his day.
Yeah, trans fats. So anyway, the episode is over. Ta-da!
You don't have any final thoughts on Die Hard?
No. It's been like over 2 hours.
Well, if we talk for another 10 minutes, it'll be just as long as the movie.
I don't really see that as a goal that I need to fulfill in my life.
No, the last thing I'll say on this is a podcast is a terrible way to talk about this movie, because one of the things I love so much about this movie is the directing and the way McTiernan moves the camera through scenes. It's just... so well done. He uses, we talked about it briefly before, but the way he uses the action of the camera and the pans and the dollies to punctuate the action in places that you need to know about things or you need to feel a certain thing. It's not all about the performance that's going to speak loudly to the audience and make them understand exactly what's going on. He does some great work with some tracking shots and then whip pans and all this fun stuff. And it's used so specifically and sparingly that when it's done, it adds so much to the film rather than just being direction for the sake of direction.
I don't know what direction for the sake of direction means, but I'm gonna...
Yes, you do. You know, like absurd, unnecessary Steadicam moves or jib moves or cranes or whatever. It's all there for a purpose in this movie.
Yeah. Well, I mean, somebody could argue that Michael Bay has all that stuff in there for a purpose too, I guess.
But, okay, so I guess that would be the extreme that I'm saying is probably a little unnecessary. I mean, mm-hmm. Like the things in this one, they punctuate
like detention.
See, detention uses a lot of the same sort of technique, I think, but yeah, it's probably used a little more often in detention. But he does a lot of things where he starts on really wide frames and the characters move closer to the frame or move away from the frame. It's longer shots, like when Powell gets out of his car for the very first time to go meet. That is incredibly loud. Is that your way of stopping?
Yeah, I was. You're on a roll, so I had to kill it.
Yeah, you made me jump in my chair, and now I am sweating.
I love dynamic mics. Just put that right up to the speaker.
No, don't do that again, please. I'm gonna turn my headphones off.
Good stuff.
I'll just talk over you.
Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah, I could talk for another 3 hours about Die Hard, but let's not. It's a wonderful movie. It takes place around Christmas, so it'll be on TV, I'm sure. I don't care if you consider it a Christmas movie or not, but you should watch it because it is a good Melon Farman movie.
Mm-hmm. And Melon now Farm.
Oh, the weather outside is frightful, but the fire is so delightful. And since we've no place to go, let it snow, let it snow, let it snow. It doesn't show signs of stopping, and I brought some corn for popping. The
lights are turned way down low. Let it snow, let it snow, let it snow. When we finally kiss goodnight, how I hate going out in the storm. But if you really hold me tight, all the way home I'll be warm. The fire is slowly dying, and my dear, we're still goodbye. But as long as you love me so, let it snow, let it snow, let it snow.